This week on Diowa, we're in Des Moines County. A gender-fluid teen is brutally murdered behind an alley.
Welcome to Diowa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaValle and Allie Tulin.
I'm laughing before I even say anything because you always give these like very fine, energetic intros, and I'm just like, I don't know how to do this.
Hey, don't try and be something you're not, Allie.
All right. Beth, we're in Des Moines County this week. See, it just sounds fake.
I think that's great.
Okay. Unlike the name, Des Moines County is nowhere near Des Moines. It's on the eastern border of the Mississippi River in southeastern Iowa, and both the county and the city derive their name from the Des Moines River, which flows through the city of Des Moines and originally flowed through the county. Have you been?
I have been. Have you?
I don't think I have.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah, good for you.
Thank you. Burlington is home to Snake Alley, which is one of the things that makes it super fun. At one time, it was labeled the crookedest alley in the world. I don't know if it's still counted as that. But it's frequently featured on Ripley's Believe It or Not, which, did you ever watch that show?
I think I did. What was the guy? It was Dean Cain was like the host of it, and he was also Superman or something.
I loved that show growing up, yeah.
That was great.
But basically, the alley was built to move traffic up and down a very steep hill. So pretty boring, but also a very cool tourist spot.
Yeah. That was a very quick fun fact. So I'm going to go into mine. Mine is that Kurt Warner, the pro football player, is actually from Burlington, Iowa. Woo. And we're both not very into sports. So I looked up some very basic facts about Kurt. He was an NFL quarterback who won two MVP awards in 1999 and 2001. He won a Super Bowl title as a player for the St. Louis Rams in 2000. And finally, he led the Arizona Cardinals to play in the Super Bowl in 2009. And he wasn't always known for football. He attended the University of Northern Iowa, or UNI, where he did not become a starter until his fifth and final year. He played arena football with the Iowa Barnstormers from 1995 to 1997. And in 1997, Kurt signed with the St. Louis Rams, and then he was sent to play for the Amsterdam Admirals of the NFL Europe the following spring. After a successful season in Europe, he went back to the St. Louis Rams as backup quarterback, and in 2017, he was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Has there been a movie about him yet?
I don't think so.
I feel like it's like a classic, if you work hard, you can do it story. Okay, one other fun fact for you.
Yeah.
One other famous person from Des Moines County was Agnes Weinrich, who was one of the first American artists to make works of art that were modernist, abstract, and influenced by the Cubist style. She lived from 1873 to 1946 and generally was popular around 1920s-ish. But her paintings had really bold colors, really geometric shapes, and were pretty abstract, kind of Picasso-esque. So maybe we can try and post some of her work on our Instagram or other social media.
Yeah.
But let's get to the murder for today, which is in Burlington, Iowa in 2016.
All right. Before we get into the story, we want to personally thank Courtney Crowder from the Des Moines Register, who covered this case extensively, and I am sure was very close to all the parties involved. This was a pretty popular case and eventually a national news story, so you may be familiar with this one. In Burlington, Iowa, on March 2nd of 2016, Burlington police found Kadari Johnson's body behind an alley. Just 16 years old, Kadari was a junior at Burlington High School. We'll go into it more later, but it should be noted here that Kadari identified as male, but liked to sometimes wear women's clothing. He had girlfriends, but he also liked men. Earlier that night, Kadari Johnson stopped by a close friend's house to try on bras. As the two talked, Johnson, who was normally very lively and enthusiastic, said that he was scared of a man named Loomney. He said he'd noticed a red car following him that day, He wasn't sure who was behind the wheel. Around 10 p.m., Kadari stuffed a few bras in his backpack, left his friend's house, and gave his mom a call. He said he was heading home, but might stop around the Hy-Vee near his apartment to use the Wi-Fi there, which wasn't unusual for him. Soon after Kadari ended the call, Hy-Vee's surveillance cameras recorded a red car pulling up beside him. Kadari got in, and that was the last time he was seen alive.
At 11:36 p.m. that night, Burlington police found Kadari's body in some prairie grass that was in the alley. Strands of hair weave was pulled from his scalp by a garbage bag cinched around his head. There was a chlorine-like smell in the air with a bottle of Dollar General brand bleach next to his body, and it indicated that this bleach was poured all over his body. There was a plastic bag with distinct pink drawstrings tied around his head. His shirt was pulled all the way up to his neck, showing a white bra and two fresh gunshot wounds to the chest. And police also noted that he may have been sexually assaulted. He was wearing pink leggings and had long braided hair extensions held back in a pink headband.
On March 11th, Burlington police put out a search warrant for a red Impala that they found out was registered to Jerron Perum's pregnant girlfriend. A few days later, officers from the Florissant, Missouri Police Department attempted to stop the car. Perum, who was driving the car at the time, fled, leading police on a high-speed pursuit through the cities of Florissant and Ferguson. That ended when he crashed into a police car. A gun was found on the passenger seat along with some marijuana in the car. So enter suspect number one, Jerron Perum. Perum was a 27-year-old from St. Louis, Missouri area. He sometimes went by the nickname Wicked West. According to court documents, he was homeless before being arrested and had no connection to Burlington. He had not held a job for 4 to 5 months prior to being incarcerated. His past convictions were time served on assault on a peace officer, third degree in Missouri, and conviction of burglary in the third degree in Des Moines County in 2013.
From the surveillance cameras back at Hy-Vee, police were able to detect that Jorge Sanders Galvez was driving the red Impala the night of Kadari's death. So this is suspect number two, Jorge Sanders Galvez. He was 22 years old, part Hispanic and part Black, and an aspiring rapper that sometimes went by the name Lumini. He and Perim are cousins and also good friends. He has one child that was 3 years old at the time that lived in Burlington. Sanders Galvez's mother is from Burlington, but she moved away, and so he grew up near St. Louis, but his grandparents still live in the Burlington area, and he visited often. Sanders Galvez had a criminal history as well. His criminal history started with curfew violations and disorderly conduct at age 17. At age 20, he had car theft and assault for punching a woman he was seeing and pushing her down a flight of stairs. In Missouri, he had convictions for theft of a controlled substance and unlawful possession and use of a weapon. And there were also some child support papers that listed no job and no savings.
For 2 weeks leading up to March 2nd, Sanders Galvez and Perum lived off and on at a house on Madison Avenue, less than 2 miles from the alley where Kadari's body was found. Because Burlington is pretty small and doesn't have a ton of crime, police were familiar with some of the more troublesome characters in town. And they knew that the house on Madison Avenue was where Sanders Galvez and Perum hung out. When police realized who was involved, they stopped by the house to search it. Police then found Kadari's backpack, laptop, school ID, and fibers that were also found at the crime scene. Perum's girlfriend also sometimes lived at the house, and it was confirmed that she let him borrow her car that night. Cedric Johnson, Kadari's younger brother, said he used to see Sanders Galvez hanging out on Maple Street, one of the neighborhood's main drags and home to the local church's community center, where Kadari used to frequent.
Sanders Galvez and Perum had been calling and texting each other in the hours before and after Kadari's death. With GPS, detectives placed Sanders Galvez's phone near Kadari Johnson's body minutes before people reported shots fired. In an interview with police, Perum confirmed that he and Sanders Galvez were driving the red Impala and picked up a, quote, petite African-American female wearing a black-colored hoodie and braided hair. Perum said shortly after the pair picked up the girl, Perum was dropped off at a friend's house and Sanders Galvez and the girl drove away together. Meanwhile, in a different interview with police, Sanders Galvez denied picking up anyone outside Hy-Vee. Instead, he said he and Perum went back to the house on Madison Avenue and stayed all night. He said he didn't know Kadari and learned about his death on Facebook.
With all of this evidence, police charged them both with first-degree murder in January of 2017. DCI and local police decided early on, quote, indicates planning and preparation to cause of death of Johnson, as well as efforts to conceal and destroy items of evidentiary value connected to the homicide. In total, the police investigation included more than 100 interviews with at least 60 people and about 300 pieces of evidence.
So let's move on to the trial. Sanders Galvez pleaded not guilty and waived his right to a speedy trial. At this point, there was still not a clear motive for the crime. Even though they were co-defendants, Sanders Galvez requested a separate trial from Purim. So since it happened first, let's go through Sanders Galvez's trial first. On May 3rd, 2017, Sanders Galvez requested a venue change and Judge Mary Ann Brown approved the trial would be held in Henry County instead of Des Moines County.
In October of 2017, this case was shared in national news when the U.S. Justice Department sent a federal hate crimes lawyer to help prosecute Sanders Galvez. Christopher J. Peraz, a prominent hate crime lawyer with the Justice Department, was added to the prosecution's team. The New York Times reported that the move to add Peraz was, quote, personally initiated by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Again, the situation was believed to be a hate crime, but no motives were disclosed.
On October 21st, the trial moved to Keokuk, Iowa. Sanders Galvez's attorney's argument was that Henry County lacked enough minority representation to ensure their client would be tried by a jury representative of his peers. Judge Brown said that Sanders Galvez's attorneys hadn't met the burden of proof to allege that, quote, any such underrepresentation is due to a systemic exclusion of the group in the jury selection, which is needed when requesting a change of venue due to jury panel relief. Instead, she still granted their motion as a, quote, proactive step to deal with issues of implicit bias. The historical statistical information indicates that there may be a more broad-based representation of different ethnic groups in the South Lee County panel than would be true in the Henry County panel, which makes having venue change to South Lee County an appropriate option for this court to consider. And then, after all that, only one person of color was in the pool of about 60 possible jurors. About half of the potential jurors had already read something about this case. According to the Iowa City Press-Citizen, quote, one man who identified himself as gay said that he might view the crime through the victim's eyes instead of the eyes of an impartial juror, while a few people said their Christian beliefs tell them that homosexuality and changing between genders are wrong. They eventually ended up with a jury of 11 white people and one black person, which included 3 men and 9 women.
The prosecution's theory, led by Peraz, said that Sanders Galvez began flirting with Johnson after seeing him leave Hy-Vee. Sanders Galvez persuaded Johnson to get in his car, then brought Johnson to a home to have sex with him and Purim. Sanders Galvez became enraged during the encounter after discovering Johnson was biologically male, and over the next hour suffocated Kadari by stuffing a rag down his throat and wrapping a plastic bag around his head, then threw him in the car and drove to another part of town, dumped him in an alley, and shot him several times until he bled to death. At this point, a federal grand jury had been convened to consider whether they could face hate crime charges, but no decision had been announced. However, Iowa law, unlike federal law, doesn't allow prosecutors to bring hate crime charges based on gender identity.
On October 24th, the lawyers discussed whether some evidence would be allowed during the trial. So one piece of evidence was a video from Sanders Galvez's phone where Purim was having sex with a woman at the Madison Avenue house while Sanders Galvez was in the background. Peraz said that the video, quote, clearly establishes that defendant Sanders Galvez and Jerron Purim, despite being cousins, were comfortable having sex in front of each other and that they were comfortable engaging in those sexual acts at 2610 Madison. These videos were eventually allowed at trial. Judge Brown cautioned that she wouldn't allow much more than one video and a few photos featuring sexually explicit material to be presented in court. They also discussed whether the defense would present evidence of the, quote, bad character of the victim. Defense attorney Curtis Dial said that while that sort of information might be appropriate in other cases, it wasn't part of his plan for this case.
The trial started on October 27th. In the opening statements, prosecutors introduced that Johnson may have been kidnapped and suffocated before being shot in the alley in Burlington. Dr. Marcus Nashelsky, the Johnson County medical examiner and a professor at the University of Iowa, testified that Johnson was killed by two bullets that entered his upper chest and that he was alive when a plastic bag was, quote, tightly compressed into his mouth. He said, quote, I can't say with certainty how long he lived before he died, but this was a rapidly fatal process. The defense attorney for Sanders Galvez did not outline a defense and did not make an opening statement.
Sanders Galvez's DNA could not be conclusively tied to any of the items the state crime lab was asked to test. But criminologist Tara Scott said she could conclusively connect Purim's DNA to the gun that the state alleges is owned by Sanders Galvez and was used to kill Kadari. Bleach probably skewed a lot of these DNA results. The prosecution team did a deep dive into both digital footprints and tied Kadari to Sanders Galvez. Kadari sometimes identified as male and sometimes identified as female, so he had two Facebook accounts, one for Kadari and one for Candace. Sanders Galvez became friends with Candace on Facebook in December 2015, and the pair had been in the same group chat, though they never had any direct personal contact through the social media site.
Sanders Galvez was, quote, an active cell phone user. He had sent about 1,000 communications, either a text message or phone calls, in the 7 days leading up to the slaying. However, there was a dead zone or gap in communication during the 90 minutes they believe Kadari's death took place.
Terrence Polk, a longtime friend of Sanders Galvez, was a witness at the trial. He said nothing unusual happened that night. He never saw Sanders Galvez with a gun, and neither of them acted unusually. That contradicted earlier witness, D'Angelo Haley, who said they both looked nervous when they came back to the apartment, and he had seen Sanders Galvez with a gun. Polk's interviews with the police were also inconsistent. At one point, he denied knowing anyone by the name of Lumney because police had accidentally said Lummy, and he said he intentionally lied. Quote, I was just frustrated, so when he asked me the question, I just gave him a blatant no.
Sanders Galvez himself went on the stand and testified. He said that he and Purim separated between 10:30 and 11:30 p.m., which is when Kadari was being suffocated. In statements to police earlier, Sanders Galvez gave different versions of the events. He tried to blame it on Purim by saying the gun he bought was for him. On April 12th of 2016, Sanders Galvez was tackled into a garage door when he attempted to flee from the St. Louis County police officers. He was carrying a gun at the time of his arrest. He said in that altercation, he had a concussion. In an interview with police just an hour after that, a detective testified that Sanders Galvez was lucid and alert when he first told police he left Burlington March 1st, the day before the murder. At the trial, he said he misconstrued the nights because of the concussion.
On November 3rd, 2017, Sanders Galvez was found guilty of first-degree murder. It took the jury just 90 minutes to decide. Hearing guilty, Katrina Johnson, Kadari's mother, apparently brought both of her hands to her face and sobbed silently. Declining to speak with the media, she called Kadari's friends and family members who couldn't be at the hearing. She could be heard saying, quote, justice was served for my baby, in the hallway. Sanders Galvez looked straight ahead, closing his eyes but not displaying any visible emotion. Des Moines County Attorney Amy Beavers said, quote, the malice in this crime was extreme and the jury obviously saw that. The defendant going to prison for the rest of his life is clearly warranted in this case.
Once in jail on December 12, 2017, Sanders Galvez and another convicted murderer brutally attacked an officer in the maximum security area for male inmates and then moved out of the jail into different prisons. They were making hooch, or homemade prison alcohol, when officers came to investigate. Two officers were injured but released from the hospital and okay. So his full sentence was now mandatory life in prison and to pay out $150,000 in restitution to Katrina Johnson. When he pled guilty, it added 12 years to his life sentence.
So there was a lot less media coverage on Purim's trial, probably because it was very similar to Sanders Galvez's. On September 18th, 2018, the lawyers disputed evidence. Judge Brown ordered both sides to avoid playing the full police interviews except to challenge inaccurate statements made by witnesses at trial. She suggested a police officer will instead testify to what Parham told him while in jail. Judge Brown also denied a motion from prosecutors seeking to show the jury certain photographs of Parham's car that were taken after his arrest near St. Louis. These photographs included images of damage to the Chevy Impala suffered after striking a police vehicle during the chase, which showed Parham had a, quote, consciousness of guilt of the killing. The defense said these images would improperly lead the jury to believe Parham was fleeing because he knew he was guilty of killing Kadari when he could be fleeing because he had a gun and marijuana in the car. While in jail, Parham also wrote a novel that features himself and Sanders Galvez as the main characters and includes stories featuring guns and drugs and other things that could prejudice Parham. The prosecution said that they didn't expect that that would be brought up in court.
During the trial, a 25-second video was shown where Parham is seen having sex with a woman at the Madison Avenue home. It was said that, quote, Parham's mother walked out of the courtroom before the video was shown. Text messages showed Parham was trying to meet up with three different women late that night after Kadari's death. Then, both Parham and Sanders Galvez both left town to St. Louis. The defense team didn't call any witnesses. According to the Des Moines Register, quote, much of the prosecution's strategy has involved tying Parham to his co-defendant and friend, Sanders Galvez.
According to the Iowa City Press-Citizen, on October 5th, 2018, quote, prosecutors delivered a blistering closing argument Thursday morning. Iowa Assistant Attorney General Laura Roan accused Parham of encouraging and participating in the murder with his co-defendant, Sanders Galvez, who was convicted of the crime last year. They acted in concert. And it was deliberate, and it was premeditated, and certainly, certainly, it was with malice, Roan said. No one knows who pulled the trigger that night, Roan said, but ultimately, it doesn't matter because the crime required the active participation of both men. If you are not the shooter, you are helping restrain that target, the victim, Kadari Johnson, at the time when he took his last breaths in the alley on Walnut.
On September 29th, D'Angelo Haley took the stand again for this trial. He said that Sanders Galvez and Parham were at his home the evening of Kadari's death with another friend, and that they showed him the gun while they smoked marijuana.
And then on October 6th, 2018, the jury found Parham guilty as well. On November 20th, Parham was sentenced with the mandatory life without the possibility of parole. Parham appealed this decision, claiming insufficiency of evidence, ineffective legal representation, and that the court wrongly permitted prosecutors to introduce the sex video as evidence. On January 22, 2021, the three-judge panel upheld the jury's verdict, and Parham lost the appeal.
Both Sanders Galvez and Parham are still serving their sentence in jail.
So let's end this somewhat on a happy note by describing the type of person Kadari Johnson was. Hundreds of people gathered for his funeral. According to the Des Moines Register, Katrina Johnson was one of several locals who shared stories of Kadari during the funeral, remembering the times he stole her heart and the times he annoyed her to the point of momentary anger. But Kadari never held a grudge, and it was impossible to hold one against him. Quote, you would never know what he would do or say. Sometimes it would be shockingly inappropriate, and sometimes it would be something that would just melt your heart.
It was said that he had an outstanding fashion sense, where he would wear leg warmers, pajama pants, and braid extensions. If he saw someone getting picked on, he was never afraid to stand up to the bullying. He lived his life proudly and encouraged others to do the same. He would do his best to make those around him feel as special as he was, no matter his mood. Mona Ash, one of Kadari's friends, said, quote, when God made Kadari, he knew this boy would need a little extra sass to get by in this world. He was one of the most resilient kids I ever met.
People said that Kadari had plans to be famous. He loved to sing and even more to dance, and he was known for his signature boisterous laugh. He'd do cartwheels or take off his shoes and slide down the school hallways on his way to class. He would sometimes get in trouble at school for dancing in the hallways. According to the high school secretary, quote, trying to stop Kadari from dancing was like trying to stop a fish from swimming. At the end of his funeral, everyone in the gymnasium started clapping and dancing in honor of Kadari.
Years later, people still remember Kadari and try to find the joy in everyday life like he did. And there's been some lasting impact in politics as well.
In October of 2017, Kadari's death prompted Iowa's first conference on transgender issues geared toward school teachers, administrators, and counselors. His death sparked conversations to promote understanding and awareness unique to transgender and gender-fluid youth.
In January of 2021, a bill moved forward in the Iowa House that would ban gay panic defense. Apparently, in some states, defendants have argued that their violent actions were justified by learning another person's sexual orientation or sexual identity, or by a nonviolent pass or come on from an LGBTQ+ person. Representative Mary Wolf, a Democrat from Clinton, supported the proposal, although she didn't think current Iowa law allows a person to legally kill another based only on their sexual orientation. Quote, "There's certainly nothing wrong with clarifying that or being a little redundant on such an important issue. From what I can tell, the Iowa Senate still needs to review this bill."
So this is definitely a case like none other we've had before. So let's discuss it with Taps.
Great idea.
Hi, Taps. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
We're in Des Moines County. Have you been?
I think I have been, but if I recall, Des Moines County is in the very southeast part of the state. And I've driven through it, but I don't think I ever hung out there much.
So no fun facts for us today?
Not that. I mean, it was close to Fort Madison, and I've been to Fort Madison, to the prison. But no, that's the only things I can think of.
All right, let's dive in. What happens when you waive your right to a speedy trial?
Not that much. And most people, especially in capital cases, or, well, we don't have capital punishment in Iowa, but most major felony cases, people waive their 90-day. Because it's going to take longer than that for the defense to prepare for the case.
Mm-hmm. Dumb question here. Are there any differences when you murder a minor versus an adult?
No. Only difference is if you kill a fetus. Oh. And that's handled differently by different states, depending on the viability of the fetus.
Are you talking about abortion laws? Are you talking about murdering a pregnant woman?
You kill a mother and she's pregnant or something like that.
Oh. When you get a ton of tips from people, as a detective, how do you sort out what's real and what isn't?
You have a lead sheet. And now, of course, all that's done by software, but you track all the leads that come in. And sometimes you might have 500-600 leads, and you make sure that somebody's assigned each one of the leads and that they have been run down to the ground, depending on what they are. And whoever's running the homicide, the supervisor or whatever, goes through that lead sheet, usually on a daily basis, to make sure all those leads are being tracked.
In, I think it was 2017, we found this quote that said, "Iowa law, unlike federal law, doesn't allow prosecutors to bring hate crime charges based on gender identity." I didn't know if this was still true today.
I think it is. But I don't want to say for sure because I don't know that for sure. There's been some discussion about it. And what did I just read something recently. Oh, there was a prison guard at Mitchellville that, and I can't remember if they were male and identified as female, female identified as male. There was a job action, which is not a criminal case, it's a civil case, but a job action taken against them. And they just won a verdict in the Court of Appeals against the state of Iowa for discrimination. And I think it was the first time Iowa courts have recognized LGBTQ, whatever, as a cause of action.
Well, I think, so there's a difference between LGBTQ+ and gender identity in Iowa law. So there are hate crime charges against LGBTQ, but not gender identity.
I don't know if that's true yet in Iowa. If you can, and really hate crime, when you say hate crime, it's really not a crime. It's usually a sentence enhancement. So when the judge, after someone's been found guilty, the judge can enhance the sentence because they deem it, the jury or the judge deem it as a hate crime. And I just don't know if that population has been covered yet under the hate crime statute. I have to look it up.
Okay.
We've heard from some reporters in the past that sometimes evidence is left out of the trial.
That would be a decision made by the prosecution and the defense. mainly the defense, because the prosecution has to expose all of the evidence that they have to the defense, and the defense gets to decide what they want to speak about or what they don't. Well, I mean, obviously the prosecution gets to bring it their case in chief, but the defense, if something was eliminated or something not talked about, the chances are it's because the defense attorney believed they didn't want to talk about it and the prosecution didn't believe it was important enough for the case.
In this case, they brought in a federal prosecutor. Like, what are times that someone would do that, or what's the main reasons of bringing in someone at the federal level?
It's unusual in a state case for a federal prosecutor to come in and assist the state. And what I found fascinating about this case is it was done under the Trump administration, which you wouldn't believe, you know, that was their focus or whatever. It's very unusual to me, because usually if the feds are going to come in and take a case, they take over the case and they take it to federal court. But in this case, it appears this prosecutor was brought in just to speak about the classification of crime as far as it being a gender crime or gender identity crime. So it's just very unusual. I don't recall a case like this before.
Why would a defense lawyer choose not to make an opening statement?
That's highly unusual too, because usually you want to make an opening statement to tell the jury what your theme of your case is. So the opening statement is kind of like reading the summary of a book before you actually start reading the book. This is what this book is going to be about. And an opening statement is important because the defense attorney gets up and says, this is why I think my client's not guilty, and goes through what evidence the prosecutor is going to talk about and things like that. So it's unusual. It's not unheard of, but it's unusual for them not to make, especially in a Class A felony case. I just find it really strange. I'm sure they had their reasons.
Okay, so once Sanders Galvez was found guilty, then Parham went on trial, and that trial didn't get like any media attention compared to Sanders Galvez. I just didn't know if you had some sort of perspective on that. I don't know. It seems really weird or like unfair to me.
You wonder if the media was fatigued by the first one and just thought it was a non-event now that the number two was being tried. You know, once all the sensationalism was over with the first trial, it was just not newsworthy as much anymore. But it's strange. It's unusual.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel too. It's like he's still a murderer though. I don't know. Something about that irks me. That's all.
Any stats that you have on transgender LGBTQ hate crimes?
No. We talked about the Tina Brandon crime. What was the name of the movie again?
Is it like Boys Don't Cry? Girls Don't Cry? It's one of those.
Hilary Swank was the actress, which happened just on the other side of the Missouri River in Nebraska.
It is Boys Don't Cry.
Boys Don't Cry. Yeah, and it was a very similar crime, but I have no statistics. I don't know how many times this has happened. I can't imagine it's a frequent crime.
Have you ever dealt with anything like it or similar?
I think I dealt with it on the street when, obviously not a murder, just somebody being beat up or something over. And you run into some, in the prostitution world, you'll run into some men that dress like women and then availed themselves as prostitutes. And then one of their clients, one of the Johns, would find out they really weren't a female, and there'd be, you know, a felony assault or something. I remember a couple of those cases.
Mm-hmm. Any final facts on this case?
No, it's a recent case. Obviously, there's probably more appeals coming down the road over it. I saw that one of the defendants was involved in a jail assault, pretty bad one. So it's just very violent. It sounds like very violent people involved.
Yep. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode.
Goodbye.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.